Andrews. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Just a quick update for committee members. We will not be hearing House Bill 2544 today, and that the bill sponsor is just not quite ready, and so we'll put that off to a week or 10 days ahead. So we'll go to our agenda and open our informational meeting and bring forward from representing Northwest Container Services, Gary Cardwell and J.R. Wilson. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me, Chairman Committee. We reckon my name is Gary Cardwell. I'm the Divisional Vice President of Northwest Container Services. And what I wanted to do today was present a combination of transportation and land use planning in regards to handling of international freight. And we've got did handouts as well as a PowerPoint. I don't know if they're going to give me the lights now.
Okay.
Shut the lights off. Our goal is smarter, simpler, safer transportation. Next. Northwest Container has been in the short-haul rail business since 1985, and what we do is we contract dedicated direct trains with the Union Pacific or the Burlington Northern to hook and haul my rail cars that are bought from Gunderson in Portland from my facility to my facility.
Gary, would you put that microphone?
Sure.
Thank you.
And in 1985, it started out really as a test program with the UP, where the Union Pacific went from a four-crew to a two-crew locomotive in that means. Next. We move international freight with virtually every steamship line that calls on the Pacific Northwest, APL, Hanjin, so on. Our service plan is we run dedicated direct trains between Portland, Tacoma, and Seattle. We have a Pasco to Tacoma, Seattle, and then we're starting in March a Quincy to Tacoma, Seattle. And I'll show you some plans that we have for expanding a Eugene to Portland, as well as a Hinkle or Boardman to Portland, Tacoma, Seattle service plan. Our strategy is to build through either privately owned or public-private partnerships a combination of facilities. Our Portland facility is the fourth largest privately owned facilities to the UP or the BN. The UP has two, the BN has one, and then we have an 80-acre facility in Portland. We're looking at Boardman, we're looking in the Eugene, we're looking in the Klamath Falls in Oregon, we're in Tacoma, we're in Seattle where we own the third largest facility. The Port of Pasco, Port of Quincy, and now we're branching down into California, all tied to moving freight from the ports inland to inland distribution centers in order to help exporters and importers move product. Again, we do that by using dedicated direct trains. And what that means is I buy the train from the railroad. I contract with them at a fixed amount to move 0 to 120 containers from location to location. And if I put 50 on that train, I pay a fixed amount. If I put 120 on that train, I pay a fixed amount. And that's the way we're able to do it. In addition to go from my location to my location, the Class 1 railroads want to do long haul. They want to do Portland to Chicago. They don't necessarily want to do Eugene to Portland or Portland to Tacoma. That's a short haul. That's less than 600 miles. They want to do the long stuff where the big dollars is. Right now we're running six trains a week between Portland and Seattle, 5 days a week between Portland and Tacoma. We're running 4 to 6 trains a month from Pasco to Tacoma, Seattle, and we'll be running 4 to 6 trains a month between Quincy and Tacoma. On average, Over the last 6-7 years, we've been moving 55,000 containers, a majority of those being Oregon exports. This year, 2005, we're actually on track to move 100,000 containers. With the two ships that left the Port of Portland back in October and November of last year, we picked up that freight. We go after it. We think it should be moved by rail other than truck on the highway, and we were successful in getting that business. We're on track to move over 100,000 containers in 2005. Variety of goods. On the import side, clothing, shoewear, machinery, tires, electronics, Columbia Sportswear, Nike sneakers, Les Schwab tires, Meijer, Kroger, Walmart, Nordstrom. On the import side, on the export side, a lot of building materials, for homes to Hawaii, roofing shingles, Christmas trees. I'm proud to say every winter from November to December, we move 500 containers of Christmas trees, about 150,000 trees from Oregon to Seattle that get on a ship and go to Hawaii. Hay and the grass straw business is a very big business in Oregon. The hay market is a $2 billion industry, and the grass seed straw is now $500 million industry. And if you're familiar with it, 10 years ago, that was a product that was burnt down to the ground, caused some major traffic accidents on I-5. They then banned the burning. A couple of different companies turned it into a product, and the grass seed straw is now sold to Japan, Korea, and Taiwan as food additives. It has more nutritional value than rice straw does. So the Asian markets are buying that up now, and that's now $500 million market of a product that we burned to the ground just 10 years ago. Refrigerated fruits, berries, French fries, all that stuff, and moving a lot of agricultural goods. Where are the exports from? Willamette Valley's got hazelnuts and grass seed straw. Central Valley has a lot of timothy and alfalfa. The Dowsett River, cherries, pears, apples, blueberries. And then Bergman, Humatilla, Hermiston, again, hay and onions and processed potatoes. A lot of French fries come out of there. We do it again where we've acquired our own rail cars through Gunderson. I've got 30 now. I've got 10 on order. Just to give you an idea, the backlog at Gunderson for rail cars, I placed an order for $2.5 million in October. I won't see those till this December because of the backlog for rail cars in the industry. Exports are heavy. Typically, Oregon exports are loaded where they weigh out before they cube out. And what we're doing is we're loading with 60,000 pounds more of product over the average state that has a 45,000-pound limit. So what does that mean? That means we can put 25% more weight into a container in Oregon and Washington and Idaho than you can in typically other states. There's a big advantage to the Oregon exporter to move those loads to market. On the import side, it's typically clothes, sneakers, lightweight commodities. They'll cube out before they weigh out. And what we provide is a pier to terminal or a pier to door move. So we try to we're really truck competitive in the service we provide. So that we get it off the port, we get it to the terminal, we get it to the door very quickly, and we can do that with large volumes. Our Portland facility, we've got 79 acres there, UP access, servicing all steamship lines. The Port of Portland, Terminal 6, has access to the UP and the BN, serving steamship lines as well. Very effective rail terminal. More and more ports are turning to on-dock rail to provide inland intermodal services. Our Seattle facility is 15 acres. Again, the Port of Seattle has a Terminal 5 with on-dock rail, Terminal 18, and Terminal 46, and then we're opening up a Terminal 25 there as well. Tacoma, we've got a facility of 15 acres as well, and then in Port of Tacoma has 3 on-dock rail systems, which is the future of getting freight from and to the ports in transportation. Port of Pasco, we operate, is a multimodal terminal. And what I mean by that is not only do we barge freight, we load barges from the Port of Pasco that go down the river to the Port of Portland, but we rail freight from the Port of Pasco to Tacoma, Seattle. So historically, 95% of the product coming out of that area is moved on barge through the Port of Portland and exported, 5% by rail. Well, within the last 6 months, that's changed from 95% rail to 5% barge, and that's due to the lack of steamship lines calling the Port of Portland. So multimodal is kind of the future of transportation, I believe. Other places, again, we talked about Quincy. Quincy, Washington is 320 acres. The idea, again, is to take it from the ports and rail it out to Quincy, where there's land available, shovel-ready land to put in a Target or a Home Depot or a Sears. And our goal is to try to match up exporters with importers. And we'll get into that a bit, but I think we need to start thinking and helping our inland locations, the Port of Morrow or Boardman, 2,500 acres of land available for importers. Tremendous amount of exporters out there. If we can match up importers with exporters, we can reduce the cost of Oregon exporters' transportation. Eugene, we're doing the same thing. So we're going where the exporters are. Chapter or San Joaquin Valley in Oakland, we are now working with the state of California to try to solve some of their transportation needs. San Joaquin Valley, again, big export area. They've already got a Sears and a Target and IKEA and some others down there, so we're moving down into the California region. Again, the need to develop inland intermodal centers, and 50% of the time, an international container on our highway in Oregon is empty because we're locating distribution centers in one location and exporters are in another location. And I'll show you some maps of how that transportation flows shortly. I think we need to think about land use planning, tying it to exporters, and improving the efficiency of our transportation system. So my crude sketch, I kind of battled my 19-month-old daughter for these markers, but I tried to color code it. We've got, of course, seafood on the West Coast. Through the center area is hay and straw, potatoes. I tried to depict where the export areas are of Oregon. Now, maybe I should, can I stand up over there and kind of just point the Thank you, Mike Salzgiver from OECD. The way, for instance, just freight right now, what I drew is freight comes into Rivergate in Portland. The import will drive down to, say, Target that's located in Wilsonville, unload, and the empty container comes back up into Portland. That empty container then gets put on the barge, barged out to the Port of Morrow, loaded, and then brought back as a load. So again, 50% of the time we're moving empties. Another example is coming into Portland, Northwest Container, Port of Portland, driven down 405-26, driven out to Nike or Columbia Sportswear, empty, brought back up here, and then the farmer from Eugene's got to drive up, get the empty, bring it down, and bring it back as a load. Again, we're locating importers in one place and our exporters are everywhere else. We've got Dollar Tree, Target, the new Lowe's going into Lebanon, Columbia Sportswear, Nike. Those are just a few of the importers. Again, none of them on where the exporters are. Next page. Then it gets a little bit more complicated because now, again, the domestic trailer comes and gets it. And what happens is he drives down, again, located in Rivergate, drives down to Target in his empty trailer, loads it full of goods, And what we're finding is that 85% of the goods that are now coming into international ports drive east on 84 heading towards Chicago. 3 or 4% will get consumed in Portland. 5 to 6% gets consumed in Seattle, Tacoma, and another 5 to 6% gets consumed down in Northern California. So now we've got even more traffic. Same thing over here. Again, domestic guy picks it up, drives out to Nike or Columbia Sportswear, then drives through downtown, heads down Eugene, drives out 84 with 85% of his product, and then 5% goes to Seattle. So I will redo these just to sell some bandwidths in the future based on volume and highway consumption. Next. So what I'm proposing in the future, for instance, is that if we could locate an importer out in the port of Morrow, then it becomes a barge load out, gets unloaded, then gets reloaded with an export and comes back, and then eventually he will come into the city with 3 or 4%, drive south with 5 to 6 and 5 to 6. He's already way outside the major city limits for 85% of his project. He's halfway out of the state. Same thing down here in Eugene. Again, matching up an importer with an exporter, where if we bring the import down to Lowe's or whoever else in the future, then gets unloaded, goes into a small CY dock, and then gets loaded with the export that I'm, you know, hopefully I will rail north, and then again drives out with the export. Substantially reduce the traffic congestion in downtown Portland. So all of the, again, a majority of the freight is coming in through North Portland, but again, a majority of the exporters are all out on the south side or the east side out along the Columbia River. I think that's my last slide. But again, just through efficient land use planning for big box distribution centers, we have, and Oregon has, 3 exports for every 1 import. So one of the things that we are working at as a state with the Port of Portland, with OECDD, is to attract importers to match up with our exports. And I'm hoping that through efficient transportation planning, we can reduce the cost of the Oregon exporter, because he's paying for all those empty moves. He's paying the $150 to barge out and empty out to the Port of Morrow. He's paying $150 to drive that empty down to Eugene to load it full of hay or straw or french fries or potatoes. So again, if the importer picks up that cost, that then just put $150 each back into the exporter's pocket, not to mention the reduced of highway congestion, air pollution, and jobs. What we're finding out is by that truck driver driving into Portland through Eugene, his insurance rates have doubled. So there's other things that, do we want our farmers investing in the trucks or farm equipment to expand his export? And that's why I'm looking for your help today and just throwing out, from the international perspective, we need to start driving importers where our exporters are.
Any questions of Mr. Godwin? What do we need to do, Greg? What kind of help do you need in land planning?
Well, you know, I don't know. That's my problem, is I have this idea, but I don't know how to do anything with it. One of the things that we're finding also is that real estate agents are really driving the model of where these people are going. And I think the state needs a go-to person for importers. Who does Walmart go to? Who does Target go to? Who does IKEA go to when they want to put a distribution center in Oregon? Who is out marketing Oregon for those things and being able to sell a better system for more efficient transportation and help our exporters? We are one of the few states in this country that has more exports than imports. So there is an advantage to us locating them further out and trying to create a better system. So I really don't know. Other than, you know, we tried to talk to the governor, and I appreciate any advice or direction you may have on who we may talk to for trying to locate these people.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize Medford is a long way from Oakland or Portland.
It's in my plan, though.
If Schefter's in there, Medford ought to be. We do have an international airport, which can take a lot of the load off of the off PDX. But my question is, in terms of container, is there much containerized material flown out, or is it mostly all shipped?
Pardon me?
Are the containers being flown across the Pacific Rim, or is it mostly just...
It's all ocean.
Ship.
Yeah. In your case, you know, an Intel would load. There's a lot of... some frozen fruits and berries now that are flown by plane, but for the most part, a value of a container of goods being exported out of this may be $100,000 versus, you know, $1 million worth of Intel chips. So, again, I think strategically locating, you could locate a biotechnology or nanotechnology or some type of technology in Medford that would use your airport.
Mm-hmm. Gary, if you're locating a distribution center, is that necessarily zoned commercial or industrial?
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
That's warehousing.
Representative Spence.
Question. Thank you very much. I live out in the gorge on I-84, and so truck traffic is a huge issue to my district, but... generally, how many truckloads per container are we talking? I mean, how many trucks does it take to fill a container? I guess is my question.
One. Yes.
So, one truck.
Right. And I'm bringing in, like I said, I'm moving 100,000 containers a year. Nike itself is probably bringing in 25,000. No, what am I saying? Yeah, 25,000 containers in Nike. A lot of what's being transloaded, again, is just driving down 84, and if you take 85% of 20,000, what is that? 15,000 trailers would be driving down I-5, down 84, heading east. Now, we're not going to change the past.
No.
You know, they're not moving, but we can relocate the future. And I think just, again, by having strategic locations on that, on the map of industrial site locations, big box distribution centers create jobs per acre, not jobs per square foot.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we want to eat up? You know, one distribution center could be 100 acres. But it may only generate 25 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But 25 jobs in Morrow is a lot of jobs. And they're sustainable jobs, they're well-paying jobs, and at the same time, we're reducing traffic back in Metro Portland.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have to get a hold of you about Climate Falls.
Thank you.
We will close the informational meeting and thank Gary and JL for that most educational piece. As I mentioned earlier, we will not hear House Bill 2544 today, so we'll move on and open a public hearing on House Bill 2537. And we have two signed up to speak on 2537, so... they're both for it, so I'll bring forward Lynn Beaton and Wayne Shivering, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shutterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And Mr. Chair, if I may, before I get into my testimony, my brief testimony on this bill, just to answer your question, Gary, what can we do? Actually, I had the pleasure of meeting with him a few months ago and seeing this presentation. Happily, the planning infrastructure is in place. That is, you have unused capacity in already zoned, appropriately zoned land in these places where he is looking. It's more a matter of the hard infrastructure, the rail, the shipping, the other transportation pieces that you need to develop. The land uses are there and waiting for this kind of an opportunity for development. And I think he said he's willing to testify later this afternoon on the intermodal transportation piece, which I'm not the expert on that. that bill, but that certainly gets at the infrastructure part of this kind of development. But in terms of the land uses, in the places he was looking at locating, Boardman in particular, you've got some huge unmet capacity there, unfilled capacity that could accommodate these uses.
Can you put those on either industrial or commercial?
It's industrial. I was going to say his are industrial, but that's what you've got zoned out in Boardman. You've got the land uses ready and available for what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's easy from your committee's perspective. It's there.
Great. Proceed on 2537.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking of economic development,
this is right up the same, just exactly what we're talking about.
That's exactly right. I think we're unsure precisely what this bill calls for the Department of Land Conservation and Economic Development to do, but we are nevertheless all for it. In terms of providing a forum to underscore, in particular I'll refer to DLCD, our commitment in the almost 1 year since the governor asked me to take the department on to use the land use planning program to support economic development, anything that we can do to further that agenda in partnership with OECDD or any other state agency or the private sector and our local government partners as well. I'm pleased to advance that and just point out that among some of the things that we are doing now with OECDD and other state agencies, we do have representatives from our department as well as OECDD involved on the governor's economic revitalization teams. We worked together on the state industrial land certification process in which OECDD took the lead. Again, the working in ERT to identify employment lands team approach to respond to requests for assistance for industrial development, and then our department work on Goal 9. Those are the big picture pieces. Also, I would say that in the last year, we have worked in partnership with OECDD and other agencies as well, including Department of Ag, on a few very specific on-the-ground kind of projects. We're very pleased to report to you assisting Malheur County with a comprehensive plan amendment and zone change that facilitated the siting there of the Treasure Valley Renewable Resources Biofuels Refinery, and in fact staying with them on appeal and using some of our resources to support them when they were appealed to LUBA, and we're pleased to be successful on that appeal. In the central part of the state, with Jefferson County, again working with them to site a feedlot that represented fewer jobs for Jefferson County, but a good market opportunity for the cattle industry in that part of the state, working with the Department of Ag in that case, again when that was appealed by some citizens to LUBA, in supporting that local land use decision. On the coast in Gold Beach, helping the city write a comprehensive plan amendment that allowed them to site a new residential development. These are things that even without waiting, we're going ahead and doing in this last year. And so anything we can do to continue that and then use a process of evaluation to demonstrate the successes that we're having, I'm pleased to support.
Any questions, Mr. Shetterly? Boy, that's a first right there.
It's a holiday.
Mark, it's a holiday.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, can I get a rain check for another appearance?
Yeah, I promise I'll be back, Mr. Chair.
Lynn?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Eaton, and I'm the manager of the Central Operations Division for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And my testimony, not surprisingly, will be very similar to that of Mr. Shetterly's. We also are comfortable with the bill, although we're not exactly sure what it wants to do, but it looks as if it's requiring things that we're doing right now. And as he has discussed, we are also involved with the ERT, or Economic Revitalization Team, efforts going on around the state. We are the agency taking a lead on the Industrial Land Certification Program, as we've testified to you before. And we're also involved to quite a hefty extent with the Goal 9 update and review, because in looking at Goal 9, it deals with economic development. Our agency is wanting to be more involved than we have really been in the past on giving input to local communities and helping them maybe get the information they need to make good decisions. In addition to those things, we continue to provide infrastructure funding, which is one of the key things that we can do for local communities to really help them with economic development, is to make sure that they've got literally the pipes in the ground and the roads there that they need to attract and maintain good business. And we're involved with what I think of as the new Industrial Lands Committee, that since we spoke with you before 2 weeks ago, we have started working with Tom Gallagher on a new group to look at industrial lands issues. And again, both of our departments have been involved with that, and we've already had 2 meetings. We have a third tomorrow. So that is an ongoing effort as well. And with that, I'll open it up to questions, too.
Lynn, what can we do when we get a gentleman like Mr. Culver here who just kind of lays it out and says, gosh, I got 25 to 50 jobs for a community. I'm going to reduce truck traffic. I'll make the environment better because I'm going to reduce truck. Why aren't we, are we doing something right now to help him?
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question, and we have spoken with him before. I haven't seen it this clearly laid out, so this was really nice just to see the visual. It helps to understand. I agree that the sites are really there. It's getting money to finish getting infrastructure in place for those sites, and then it would probably also be largely up to our department to then make sure that you've got those network pieces in place and that we're getting the exporters and the importers to the same place. And to be honest with you, I'm not with our international division, so I don't do that on a daily basis, and I'm planning on going back and talking with them about it. But that is the kind of thing that we do, is look for opportunities to match up those different players. I thought it was a very impressive presentation and pretty interesting, so I plan to go back and ask folks what we can do.
Great. We appreciate that. Any other questions? Lynn, I'm going to ask if you'll stick around for just a second, because we have a question from the committee in regards to another issue. So I'm going to...
What can I say?
Aren't you lucky?
Is there anyone else who wishes to give public testimony in regards to House Bill 2547? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on 2537 and open a work session on House Bill 2537, and the chair would look for a motion. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 2537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any disagreement?
Would you care to
make your motion and move it to the consent calendar?
So moved.
Representative Anderson has moved it to the consent calendar. Take a roll call, please.
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Raymond?
Aye.
Nola?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
House Bill 2537 is moved to the floor on the consent calendar with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, committee. We close the public hearing on House Bill 2537, and we'll reopen a work session. Now we'll open a work session in regards, committee. Representative Greenlick had a question. Since last Wednesday, you have received a document from DLCD dated February 14th, summary of Measure 37 claims, and attached to it was a breakout sheet of data. And Representative Greenlick wanted to ask Director Shetterly a question in regards to that. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You don't have this in front of you, but there's a column that says statutes and or rules. And several of them are blank, but I suppose there's something. It just hasn't been determined. But others talk about city-only or county ordinances Which side are you looking at? Whichever. The sun.
I have Deschutes County. Which one do you want me to look at?
Okay.
Baker?
Start with Baker. The third one, the second one, for example. Cities only county ordinances. And there are several that talk about that. or such things down under Cook County as all zoning since 1978,
mm-hmm.
things like that. Is it, well, I mean, these don't necessarily seem to be a state issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood. What this reflects is the information that is presented on the claims. So in some cases where you see blanks, for instance, on desired use, that is a claim that as it sits in our process right now has not identified a desired use. They're just asking for a waiver without identifying a use attached to that. And others, such as a second one, or if you look down about midway down from Columbia County, it looks like one ORS and OAR pertaining to any land use slash zoning regulation. That again reflects how those claims come to us. What we do in the evaluation process is do our best to identify from the information in the claim what exactly it is that they're asking to have waived. And we have in the claims process now, we're actually corresponding with these claims to try and tease out the information to be able to enable us to be able to evaluate their claim and, if appropriate, grant a waiver for the appropriate ordinances or rules or statutes. But what you see here is just what we find on the claim forms as they come in. Obviously, some provide more information than others.
I may just have probably follow. But if, say, you really find out this is about a zoning regulation that happened in Cook County in 1997 or something, just under general land use authority, will that go away as a state claim then?
Yes, thank you. I didn't get around to that part of the question, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenwood, if we get a claim that raises only a city ordinance, for instance, or a zoning code that does not relate to any state requirement, we will simply indicate that we don't have any interest in or authority over this claim. In county cases, claims, it's more likely that we're going to have some overlapping jurisdiction because of the way the land use structure is set up. But even in those cases, if you have a county ordinance that simply does something that the county elected to do that goes above and beyond whatever the state requires, we would respond in the same way that we just don't have any interest in or even authority to waive or not apply that kind of an ordinance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my curiosity.
Thank you, Lane, very much. We'll close the work session on the Measure 37 summary. And committee, on Wednesday, we will be taking up a bill that some of you will be familiar with. It was 3015 in last year's session. It's in regards to lot of record, in case you'd like to do a little background before we get into it on Wednesday. It's Dennis Richardson's bill, and that one bill will probably consume most of our meeting on Wednesday, and at this point we will have no meeting on Friday. Okay? We hereby adjourn the House Committee on Land Use.